Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Let's have a look at the front pages first. And obviously the Stardust tragedy is still very much dominating the papers. So the Sunday Independent is leading with that there's going to be a state redress scheme for Stardust families after Dáil apology, compensation to follow in due course, they say. You will remember, of course, you will have heard during the week that the price for a dead child back in the 80s when there was originally compensation paid was 7,500 per child. They're also saying criminal review will examine culpability. So I guess the coroner's report goes to the guards now, and certainly a lot of the families are very keen that there would be a criminal investigation, but that remains to be seen, I suppose. On the front of the Mirror, Lisa Lawler. Lisa, you will know, lost both her parents when she was 17 months old, and she certainly wants a criminal investigation. The Sun on Sunday has Antoinette Keegan on the front, and the headline is "Do the Right Thing, Simon." And Antoinette Keegan making it very clear, as she did yesterday, that if this apology is not right, we won't be accepting it. And it does sound like people want a very comprehensive apology for the distress that they were put through by the state, is how they would see it. So just a kind of a vague sorry, they're saying won't cut it. The Sunday Times is leading with a poll they have, and Harris helps Fine Gael close in on Sinn Féin. Yeah, kind of. I think Fine Gael up one in it, but one finding they're taking out of it is a third of young people are more likely to vote for Fine Gael, according to that poll. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with a kind of related matter to the protest on Roderick O'Gorman's house. Vile online threats to hunt and kill all ministers. Garda Commissioner Drew Harris has come under intense political pressure to get tough with far-right agitators after sinister online threats were made to kill government members. And the Business Post is leading with, so last week the Business Post had a budget bonanza for the rest of us, and this week it's leading with a budget bonanza for businesses. Coalition plans tax rebate but rules out new VAT cut, and there's various other suggestions of things they might do for business. Now, our panel this morning, Dr. Robbie Smith, is Head of Journalism, Media and Communications at Griffith College Dublin, and he's a former Sinn Féin General Secretary. Mick Clifford is a Special Correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Dr. Emmanuel Sean Quinlivan is a lecturer in European Politics at UCC, and Lorraine Sweeney is a businesswoman. Lorraine, you need to get yourself a more elaborate title there.
Actually, I do have an honorary doctorate, which I didn't mention.
Okay, so we're three doctors in the house. Okay, if I have any kind of a medical event anyway, I'm covered. Mick Clifford, you've picked the front of the Sunday Independent on the Stardust, but just where are we at now?
Where we're at now is very quickly after the verdict last Thursday, Brendan, the Taoiseach, he made a personal apology by all accounts yesterday to the families, and he intends to make an apology in the Dáil on Tuesday. The most notable thing about that is how fast it has occurred.
He's moving very quickly.
He's moving very quickly. Now, one of the reasons I would suspect for that is normally in scenarios like this, the government or the Taoiseach would get legal advice to the effect that apologies could infer that there's going to be financial liabilities as a result. And I think we saw that with a number of issues, historic issues, and they were slow coming and they were put in a particular way, etc., etc. That doesn't apply here. But what is noticeable here is that there's going to be what one might describe as a proper compensation fund for the victims, because the one, and you mentioned there, £7,500 for the loss of a child, the original one, is now, it's accepted that it was completely inadequate. And it was opened with a lot of pressure being put on the relatives to accept it or else face the possibility of possibly losing everything they had if they went to the High Court and took legal actions. So the government are paying the money, but I don't think they have the financial liability. But it's a very positive thing that they are. Just one quick thing to take away from the whole thing that strikes me. And a huge amount of all this, it can be traced back to a single line in the tribunal report that was done after the fire. That was a very good tribunal report in a lot of ways. It was very...
This is Ronan Keane's report.
It was very analytical. It went into the evidence lot. It was highly critical of some of the alleged safety practices in the complex. Now, despite that, and despite there being no evidence, and it's been accepted legally even since that there was no evidence, he said the probable cause was arson. And if that line hadn't been in the report, I don't know whether we'd even be where we are today, because of the impact that had on the families and the stain it was perceived to put on communities that somebody among them had actually started a fire that was responsible for this. And there are echoes...
That is a primal wound.
Absolutely, it would strike. Absolutely. And it's also indicative of the time in a huge way, because there are parallels with this and, for example, the Kerry Babies Tribunal that happened 3 years after that, in that something was done in the tribunal, it was set in stone thereafter because of its legal standing. And it was seen decades later that this was totally wrong. And I'd suggest that a huge amount of what occurred there had to do with the hierarchical society and the way things were perceived, and the lines get thrown in there that are, for which there are no evidence, effectively. And it has taken decades to roll back from that.
OK. Robbie?
Well, I think everyone would welcome, but you wonder why it has been such a journey for these families. And to me, it's emblematic of the mistreatment and denial of, you know, basic rights for people. And it's not an isolated case.
Are you back to what Mick is saying there about that, where these people came from and their class was an issue here, yeah?
Yes, but also just as individuals, they have to spend over 30 years in court and tribunals for a basic... It's not just them. If you think about the Hep C people, the cervical cancer, Garda whistleblowers, you know, again and again, the state has mistreated individuals just pursuing a simple justice. And I think, if anything, what has to be learned, I think the Sunday Independent has an editorial today, why does it take a crisis to get here? But there's something systemic wrong in how the state and its institutions deal with people on a basic level. And I think the story of, I think it's Bridget McDermott and like three children, and like it's every parent's nightmare, isn't it? To your children go out and they're going to come home. And I know myself, you wonder where your children are at times, but to have to live with that afterwards is just shocking.
And we saw Mrs. McDermott yesterday, and I think she was kind of saying, well, yes, but, you know, it's no good turning another way. I mean, justice needed to be done, but what good is it to that poor woman? And as you say, I saw a line somewhere like about how people have spent their whole lives fighting this. This has been their life, like, and yeah.
Well, she says in the report her marriage broke up because she wanted to continue to fight and her husband didn't. And that's another sacrifice.
Her husband was a firefighter, which I think was ironic.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to pursue it because he thought he might lose his job.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very tragic.
And also tormented by the fact that he felt if he had been on duty that night, I think, wasn't it, that he might have been able to do more. Lorraine, there is an important aspect to this. It might seem a bit prosaic, but it's not really. Without getting... Frank MacDonald has quite a dense piece in the Sunday Independent, but you could probably speak to this. The whole... like the fire laws, the regulation, the enforcement of the regulation back then.
Yes, I mean, I'm looking at it from a business perspective and being in the hospitality business where we're ruled by, you know, regulations that we just can't ignore under any circumstances whatsoever. And the really what Frank MacDonald is saying here today in his article is that lax laws and outdated legislation led to the tragedy. He says much of the blame lies with local government. And I would have to say I agree with that. He's in the headline of his article. He's saying that the laws were drawn up under an act of 1890. And this was in 1980. So as it happens, just before the tragedy, the licence of this premises was renewed. And the Dublin Fire Brigade had done an inspection just a few days beforehand. So really, the country was ill-equipped to deal with a tragedy.
And it sounds like the expertise was not there. I mean, how does a fire inspection work now? Who does it, for example?
Well, the fire officer does it.
Okay.
And you can't move without the fire officer approval for anything, to be honest with you.
And these are people with expertise in materials, in building and all of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you can't renew your licence every year without the inspection. And, you know, he will determine you have to do X, Y and Z because there's new updated legislation since you got it last year. And you rush out and you do it because otherwise you can't function. You have to close the doors. And also the mindset of people has changed dramatically. I mean, I can't imagine how anybody thought about putting a chain on a fire door. And it was happening in those days. But nowadays, you know, we just can't even contemplate in business not obeying the rules and regulations of the fire officer.
OK, so that is like that, as boring as it is to talk about fire regulations, that is some comfort to people that the country has changed a lot in that respect.
Absolutely, dramatically. And, you know, when I was reading about the Stardust, obviously there's heartfelt stories, but when I was reading about it, I was trying to get into my head, how does any business function, or how did any business function with the kind of mindset is to stop people coming in the back door, they change the fire escape. And that's unfortunately what caused the death of all these people.
It was a mindset back then. It was almost everything that could have gone wrong, though, did go wrong. It was
absolutely
such a confluence of awful circumstances, from materials to doors to everything.
One quick thing about that, the modern fire safety legislation grew out of what happened in the Stardust. But I think we need not forget, the Celtic Tiger years were only a while back. Up to 100,000 apartments were built with deficient fire safety features, largely on the basis that they weren't inspected and because there was a lackadaisical attitude that, to be fair, goes beyond local government and feeds into the general atmosphere type. That's going to cost $4 billion. There was a young couple in Blanchardstown who died as a result of some of those deficiencies. Apart from that, we can consider ourselves extremely lucky there wasn't something far greater in terms of fires that could have started in any of these apartment blocks. That's only 20 years ago, so things haven't changed massively either.
Okay. Emmanuel, you don't share the folk memory, I suppose, of the rest of us on this. What are your thoughts on what you've seen in the last week as someone who's come to live here?
Yeah, as you mentioned, Bridget McDermott's story and her testimony yesterday, you know, saying that it was all fine. And she believed that the government was being like truthful, unreservedly apologising. But at the same time, it was too late. She's 87. She's lost her three children. You know, as Robbie was saying, her life was destroyed by this particular event. And I've been here 24 years and I've heard of many different inquiries in miscarriages of justice and etc. It's incredible that it took 43 years for those families to see the truth come out, to see the memories of their children being restored, because they were sullied with this accusation of it being arson. Mm-hmm. And yes, you know, the articles that have been relayed in the papers are really heartbreaking. The truth is extremely important, it's good that it's finally come out.
Yeah, and by the way, that piece that Mosty mentioned with Mrs. McDermott, that's by Bo Donnelly, and it's in the Sunday Times, and there's a lot of fine journalism, it has to be said, today. Probably a certain amount of guilt among the media, politics. Mick, would you agree?
There were individuals. Charlie Bird should get a mention. Charlie Bird was somebody who stuck with the families a long time, and Charlie's famous quote was that if the people who died had been born in Donnybrook rather than Bonnybrook — Bonnybrook's up near the Northside Shopping Centre in Coolock — if they'd been born there, we could have had a very different outcome. But Charlie and a few others, to be fair. So I have to admit, Brendan, 10 years ago I remember interviewing Antoinette Keegan and I had great sympathy for her, but I remember thinking to myself, I think they haven't a hope of getting what they're looking for. So the perseverance of those women, I think, was just so outstanding.
Yeah. So Mick, in terms of where this goes now and everything, I suppose the first question is, has justice been done? Second question is, without getting into any specifics of people or anything else, there's talk in that piece in the front of the Sunday Independent now. Christy Mangan, ex-guard, is talking about that this is a very significant finding by the coroner's court, and that this goes now to the guards. Yeah. What do you think the likelihood?
Well, justice hasn't been done to the extent that there's a verdict of unlawful killing, and there nobody has been identified or has been prosecuted for that unlawful killing. The second issue is you're talking about an event that happened 43 years ago. So the chances of a successful prosecution are not, they're not totally negligible, but it's very difficult to envisage. Notwithstanding that, the report from the coroner will go to the Gardaí. I think the first thing they have to examine is whether anybody who's potentially liable is still alive. And thereafter, they have to examine the quality of any evidence that's there and see whether they open a full Garda investigation into it.
Okay, we'll leave that there for now and we'll take a break. Dr. Robbie Smith, Mick Clifford, Dr. Emmanuel Sean Quinlivan and Lorraine Sweeney are staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Dr. Robbie Smith, Mick Clifford, Dr. Emmanuel Sean Quinlivan, and we now realise Dr. Lorraine Sweeney as well. Mick and myself, I feel you need to go off and do a PhD. Emmanuel, you picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday, Garda's soft tactics queried by Debbie McCann. This is around the protest at Roger O'Gorman's house.
Yes, indeed. So, as we know, there were masked men who put out messages on a Roderick O'Gorman's home and messages that were offensive, misinformation. And it just participates in this harassing, bullying atmosphere that politicians have got to face nowadays. And it's at every level of politics. It's at local level of politics. It's at national level of politics. And can I just say, not only in Ireland, in France as well, we've had, politicians that just step out of politics, or young people who just do not want to stand up for election.
Yeah, I'd have to say the impression we'd have here is that the French are far more active in this kind, that we're quite quiescent to politicians compared to the French, that they like to.
We've had the yellow vest experience. Is that what you're referring to? Yes, absolutely. But here you've had continuous stories of either physical or verbal intimidation of politicians, whether they are campaigning or just doing their job, quite honestly, representing us. And I just think this approach of the Gardaí of just fining people. I know they're trying to toe the line between not inflaming the situation, but just finding people who are intimidating, harassing a national representative is not enough and should be indeed queried, as the article points out, and it should be investigated.
Tell me about decivilization.
Yes, so in France we've had this debate. So you were saying France is further down the line. It's been actually quite prevalent in France, this this climate of violence towards our local representatives. And I'd like to focus on the local representatives, because at the end of the day, they're our first door into democracy, right? And we have local mayors. And in France, your local mayor is the person you know. Like in Ireland, your TD is probably the one you know. You know, the Lord Mayor, you don't necessarily know it, and not everybody has a Lord Mayor. But you would know your mayor. There are 36,000 communes, right? And there is nearly a mayor for every single commune.
And we'd all know from the property shows mainly that when people want to do up a house in France, you have to go down to the mairie.
Absolutely, you have to go to the mairie and etc. Yeah. But for that particular reason, let's take your example of doing up the house. Let's say that the mayor explains that no, you're not entitled to paint your door that colour, because the little commune has a certain kind of number of rules. Increasingly, the result has been resort to violence. And the link with decivilization is that you have a political scientist in France called Jérôme Fourquet, who has who has linked actually the the paucity of the use of the French language to the increase in violence in the political arena. This resort to social media, to the texting language, the decline in France in the PISA ranking, you know, the international rankings of regarding schooling, links up with the inability of French people to express their feelings, their violence, their feelings, their opinions, their discontent, and the resort to violence.
Yeah, we forget it's a very thin veneer. Robbie, what did you think about what happened around Roderick O'Gorman's house and the general response to it?
I was shocked when it happened. The idea of masked men being outside a house, and there was a Sinn Féin TD in 2019. His car was burned, and then his house was attacked. I'm a bit disconcerted about when the term far right is used, because I'm not really sure what the term means. But I do know what racism is, and I do know what xenophobia is, and I do know what intimidation is. But there's also a question, I think, that was brought up about the idea of how the guards make decisions about arresting people and planning on this thing, because it's really important that our public representatives, they're the people that we elect to do things, and they need to feel safe at the very most basic level to go to work.
And also, as Roderick O'Gorman himself said, and as others have said around it, we have a tradition in this country of the politicians being close to we won't say ordinary people, but close to the rest of us, and being able to walk among us and live among us and all of that, and that's important to us. Mick, the guards seem to be under political pressure here. Like I thought Simon Harris's comments were quite pointed about the guards.
Yeah, I'd like to know the specific details. I mean, if there's a scenario whereby Gardaí were on the scene and there were individuals in balaclavas and masks or masks of any sort, then I'd be very worried that they didn't move against them immediately.
No, Paul Reynolds reported on RTE the other night that the guards came along and said, OK, you've had your protests, now move along, and that they did go then. But we don't see...
The issue is how the protests initiated. And I do understand the approach to it, that the Gardaí don't want to get involved in using batons because they'll inflame it, they'll be all over social media, and you'll feed into what's already a very ugly discourse on social media, and it's getting uglier, and it has its roots, some of it, in people, as Robbie says. I'm sceptical about who exactly is the far right, but there's definitely has a roots in people who want to spread anti-immigrant stuff in particular, and that's leaking into the political arena. Now, I was writing about this yesterday. People need to hop on, because if you create that atmosphere, then those who are thugs and who'll go out and do that sort of thing, they feel that they've impunity in doing it, and they'll feel certainly that the general population won't react against them if they do it. So I think everybody needs to get a hold of themselves, and the Gardaí do need to review things, but unless you know the actual details of operationally what happened on the ground, because like everything else in that scenario, it's spread in social media and the truth gets buried. So that'll be the thing about it, I think.
Lorraine.
Yes, Brendan, on the Independent on page 5, Ali Bracken gives her account of it. And some of these people who were masked men were also present in O'Connell Street. And we all know what happened in O'Connell Street.
So
it got totally
anyway,
out of hand, and they called upon other people to come. And, you know, obviously arriving in the masks, they were hoping for a bigger surge of people to come. And I think, you know, the outturn of what happened in O'Connell Street, really effectively a lot of people got away with what they did in O'Connell Street. And it was the worst we've experienced in years. This is racism at its very worst. And those of us who are providing facilities for incoming refugees have to be afraid that these people shouldn't be let get away with it, because these people are entitled to be protected. And the minister was targeted because of his involvement in refugees. And clearly it's wrong.
So as someone who is at the kind of hard end of this then, There's a continuum here as well, though, or a line, isn't there, between like local people protesting who have, you know, the phrase legitimate concerns and everything, and then there's this other sinister element.
Well, I don't think these people are representative of the broad perspective in Ireland at all. I think there is a welcome for international protection and Ukrainian refugees. But it's very easy to incite the wrong people to join them. And I think that's what happened that time in O'Connell Street with the demonstrations and the fires and all that went on. Like, there's a fear here that we're just targeting incoming refugees. And probably mostly they're targeting is the international protection refugees. And sometimes in a local area where there are genuine concerns, it gets confused with the right wing total unacceptability of them welcoming in refugees from around the world.
Robbie, what do you think about what Mick was saying there about the discourse in general? Presumably that's something you keep an eye on as an academic in this area.
Yeah, and the impact of social media and political discourse, we just don't know, because it's so, this is like, you know, the Gutenberg's printing press all over again, how we talk about politics, how politics happens, how it happens with people, how they make decisions. That is all suddenly in a different galaxy, if you think about it. But also, you know, if you look on TikTok and Instagram, you can see canvassers from all parties getting harassed these last couple of weeks being out. And I think this is what's really important. We're less than 50 days away for elections for the European Parliament and local government. And if we can't protect the people who are in the democratic process, who are looking to get elected or looking to represent these communities, that's a big, big problem.
Emmanuel, related to this, you picked this piece in the Mail on Sunday, Who's Leading the Electoral Scrolls? And this is about the parties, the political parties on social media.
Yes, and that's what I thought it was particularly interesting, because as Robbie is saying, you know, politicians are increasingly trying to connect renew a connection with their electorate. So they have gone on every single platform. And this particular piece was done by, Damien Mulley, who's a social media analyst. And he looked at the social media footprint of different political parties on TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. Ultimately, he concluded that, people take a very cynical view of political parties, that it's not very different from a face-to-face interaction, except that it's on social media, so it can be shared much more widely, actually. Sinn Féin leads in terms of views, but views doesn't mean likes, doesn't mean engagement, and certainly doesn't mean votes either. But 1 million views for Sinn Féin posts on TikTok, and Fine Gael comes at 500,000, nearly half, you know. But the most followed politicians would be, in declining order, Leo Varadkar, Simon Harris, and Mary Lou MacDonald. All this, I mean, this was a very interesting piece, I thought, but ultimately for as a lecturer in politics, I'm just interested in, but what does it mean in terms of democracy, in terms of democratic engagement, right? Yeah. And yet you have a Holly Cairns, right? A Holly Cairns and Richard Boy Barrett and Paul Murphy have seen an increase of up to 70% in their social media engagement, right? An increase in terms of their followers in social media. Yeah, but what does it lead to is my question. And the piece doesn't answer this, but that's why it was a double piece in the paper. And I still find it interesting, because I was like, everybody's wondering about whether social media is going to renew our democracy, or in a democracy 2.0.
I think everyone's wondering if it's going to coarsen it, though. Isn't that the real worry here?
I just think we, again, just to link it to France, where, I come from, Emmanuel Macron started with a very, with a platform saying, I'm going to regenerate politics.
He was bringing the ethos of a tech startup, wasn't he?
Exactly.
Starting up a political
tech
party.
Startup, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And where are we now, nearly 7 years later, to, nothing. There's no grassroots movement, you know, that embodies his party. So you just wonder, social media and this visibility and this TikTok appeal, but what does it mean for people's lives? Well, what does it mean for their democratic engagement?
Where it appears to be leading it currently in this country is towards disaffection with all political parties.
Yeah,
and I think that's largely because all political parties across the spectrum are delivering stuff to people that is unpalatable to them, that they don't want to hear. That's just reality because of the expectations that are raised on social media. And the outcome of that has been that there's a flocking of people towards independence. Because basically independents can say whatever they want
easy answers.
In government.
Yeah, Robbie.
I don't know if that's strictly true. I think we're at a moment of change, pivotal moment of change. And I have classes full of people in their early 20s. And I have really high hopes for this generation because maybe, to paraphrase, they can see through the bullshit.
Yeah.
And they're going to give us all a comeuppance in terms of what they expect and what they demand. And,
but does change for you mean that they will vote for Sinn Féin? And
I would
that
hope.
Would be the
I would
change.
Hope so. But, but I think they're going to vote for other people too. But
it's mixed. There's a load of random independents as well.
No,
maybe
I don't think that's the case. But I think
Sinn Féin are losing to independents at the moment.
We're not.
According to the opinion polls.
We're the largest political party.
Oh, I know that, but according to the opinion polls, about 8-9% have gone, and it hasn't gone to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, it's gone to independence, it's left Sinn Féin.
Yeah, are you worried about that?
Well, I think Sinn Féin take those things really seriously, and you have to earn people's votes. That's not going to be easy. But in previous...
So a listening exercise, is that kind of where
I think it's partly that, but,
if
you think about, 2002 and 2007 with Fianna Fáil, as the leading party, all the focus was on them. And they dipped in those, months before. But in both cases, as it got closer to decision day, they were able to earn those votes. And I think Sinn Féin will do that and they will be the ones.
Lorraine.
All Robbie's students who are so smart will leave the country if we don't get our housing situation sorted
out.
Yeah,
you picked Shane Coleman's piece here. Hard to believe you're well off in your 20s if you sleep in your childhood bed.
Exactly. And to be honest, I think, our Taoiseach has a unique opportunity now to act on this huge fundamental problem that we have in Ireland, is that our young people are leaving the country. They're the best educated we've had in our history. And, we're short of staff in the country, and we cannot give an opportunity either to give a social housing or to give a house to purchase to young people in Ireland today. They cannot get finance. They're stuck in their parents' homes and they're not as well off as their parents are. And I think that's a major tragedy in the country today. And this is the biggest challenge that the politicians have. And I was asking Robbie outside, can Sinn Féin solve those problems? Because, it's not necessarily social housing is going to resolve the problems. It's allowing people to be able to rent a property at a value that they can afford, given their salaries, and to buy a house then ongoing from that to raise a family in. That's our major problem.
What did you answer to that, Robbie?
I said, of course. but if you think about the simple fact that Mary Lou got pilloried before Christmas because she suggested a house shouldn't cost more than 300,000.
She didn't say how you get there, Robbie. That's the whole problem.
I think they've said that again and again. The answer is to build houses, and to build houses where people can buy them, build houses where the state might 50-50 support them. That's the solution. And it has to happen. Like we've had decades of underbuilding. And it's not also, it's houses people can live in. Like I was looking at the figures for the amount of new houses in Dublin, 70% of them were apartments. And I just wonder who's going to be living in them.
Well,
if you have children and they need a place to study.
A Ukrainian guest of mine recently left our accommodation to rent one of those properties for €2,850 a month and not allowed to rent out a room to supplement the rental income. And I just don't know.
Why not allowed to
rent? It's part of the lease agreement.
Okay,
that you can.
Sorry,
can I just finish on the Shane Coleman article? What he finished in it was that the system and the establishment are rotten and needs replacing, and that's the perspective of young people today.
Can I go back to that Ukrainian who moved into that apartment? Mm. Where are there Ukrainians moving out?
Yes, there are.
And where
some.
Are they going? And
well,
do they
some
have
of
options?
Them, some of them are getting offers under the €800 a month scheme, Very few, I might add. And actually, the Red Cross did a further appeal in the last week for to encourage people to offer so that people can move on. I mean, for example, one family is moving on now. They recently had a baby. There's a mother, father, and there was a child, and now they've had a baby and they've got an offer of a Red Cross accommodation. This particular family was grandparents, parents and two children. The grandparents are on the pension. The parents are working part time, and the figures just don't add up for me to how they can afford to rent in Glenageary for $2,850 a month without subletting out some of that accommodation. For Ukrainians, it's pretty hopeless that they're 2 years in Ireland. They're getting state accommodation, but it's not for the long term. And there's no hope of them buying a home in Ireland, as we all know. And there's certainly no hope of them being able to afford to pay that rent on the income that they're earning.
Okay, and there's no hope of them going back to Ukraine in the near future either. Is your sense in general, though, that if things were to be in some way fixed in Ukraine, that they will ultimately move back?
I think there are many of them that would like to return, but some of their homes are wiped out. Can I mention briefly that, I mean, obviously to mention Ukraine is really important, and it didn't hit the papers, but yesterday in the US, they granted $68 billion for Ukraine in the Congress at last, because they were running out, Ukraine was running out of arms and all the tools they need to fight a war. And the president said yesterday, thank you, America. So there might be a bit of hope now coming for the Ukrainians that the war might accelerate and they might end it quicker. But for the Ukrainians living in Ireland, the prospects, the half of them that want to stay won't get social housing, they won't buy a house and they won't be able to rent. So what's the solution? I don't know.
Okay, Emmanuel, you want to come in there on the broader Ukraine question, which is completely, we have, Gaza has turned into a massive kind of culture war, if you will, in this country. Yeah. We're almost an obsession, but to the extent that possibly people have taken their eye off the Ukraine ball, which would seem in ways like a much more immediate problem.
Absolutely.
For those of us in Europe.
Absolutely. And when you talk about culture war, I was blown away, and I don't know what Robbie's experience has been, but, you know, I walked into my class 2 years and 2 months ago, European politics, and we talk about the invasion of Ukraine, right? And the students are like, yeah, okay, yeah, you know, wow, you know, war on the European continent at the borders of the European Union. But my goodness, on the 7th of October, you know, I had a class on the 10th of October, and the tension, the emotion regarding the Hamas Israel war was rocket high for something that is so far away from us, when we have something on our border that is so vital for us, quite honestly, I think. And actually, I'm not going to again mention Emmanuel Macron too much, but yeah. his journey in terms of going from I'll talk to Putin, you know, and I'll turn him around, to there is no red line, and I am not saying we will never go into Russia, you know, or, you know, go into Ukraine to help Russia, to help Ukraine push back Russia, is a testament to, I think, a lot of changes in the European Union. But just on Ukraine, I just wanted to add that the European Council conclusions included the support within days or weeks regarding air defence systems, which Ukraine has been requesting for years,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
And it kind of comes at a perfect timing with the House of Representatives voting of the aid package.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would say it's about time. We're all going around saying we want Ukraine to be able to defend themselves.
Absolutely.
And us, and win this war, but we would not give them what they needed to do it. So yeah, it's all interesting. Now, I mentioned the Sunday Times poll earlier, and I said Fine Gael was up 1%. They're up 3%. I beg your pardon on that. And
Sinn Féin just up 1.
Yes, I'm about to give it all. Sinn Féin 27, up 1. Fine Gael 20% up 3, Fianna Fáil 16, no change, Independence other 16% down 1, Green 6% up 1, Labour 5% no change, Social Democrats 4% down 3, Aintu 3% down 1, People Before Profit Solidarity 3% no change. The poll was carried out between April 12th and 17th with a sample of 1,100 adults and a margin of plus or minus 3%. And I think the big key lesson we can take from all of that is don't casually mention a poll because you're only making a rod for your back. Okay, we'll take a break. Robbie Smith, Mick Clifford, Emmanuel, Sean Quinlevin and Lorraine Sweeney staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back, Dr. Robbie Smith, Mick Clifford, Dr. Emmanuel, Sean Quinlevin and Lorraine Sweeney still with us. Mick Clifford, Niamh Horan has an interview with Eamon Dunphy today. It's like olden days, wasn't it?
That is the lion in winter, I think. I'm actually surprised to see he's going to be 80 next year and he still hasn't lost that age that we know him for. And I have to say, one element to him is the man has an unbelievable appetite for work. At that age, he's still producing two or three podcasts a week and he's still totally plugged into everything. But one quote that kind of shows that that old age has not softened him. He's not impressed by Simon Harris. He describes Simon Harris as a stroker. He's a superficial puff of wind. I think they're the kind of comments that Eamon would have had gone back 20, 30 years, and he hasn't softened in that regard. But it's a very interesting interview.
And look, in the absence of anyone, I'll just say, no, he's not. Okay. just to cover us off on that. The other thing, look, we could talk about this every week, Robbie, right? But it is kind of more in the frame at the moment, and particularly after prime time the other night. Colin McGurk writing about it in the Mail on Sunday today, swapping screens for a good book could set your children up for life. And Colin Murphy writing about it in the Sunday Indo as well, social media as addictive as cigarettes.
Yeah, and the DCU report was shocking. About 23 minutes it took for
this is the boys one.
Yeah, the toxic material to come to them on just I think they had a sock puppet exercise. It was just shocking. Anyone who has children or teenagers with phones, and it's hard enough to get people to talk to you on a normal day and they're just stuck in their phone and you haven't a clue about what's happening to them or what pictures they're looking at. It's been shown time and time again that this is not good for people. There was a horrific death in Britain where a woman took her own life, a young girl. We are on the edge of something that we don't understand. So, and in Ireland, it's probably more important because in terms of the European Union and the Digital Services Act and the EU Markets Act, the main companies are in Ireland and they should be regulated from Ireland. And we need to show the way here, really, in the criteria that these companies are going to be regulated with. And I don't see it happening.
Yeah, interesting as well. Colin Murphy makes the point that as long as we're talking about the material that's on there, the big tech companies are okay with that because they will say, well, we will do stuff about the material, but that there's fundamentally something more going on there. It's not just the material.
I think the problem is they're making profits from something that they can't control. And if they're going to control it, it might affect their profits. And that's the real issue. It's not been said, but that's they have created a beast that they can't control, but is very, very profitable.
Yeah. Lorraine, as a parent, what's your experience of it and the development of people in your house?
Yeah, I think it's very scary. I'm lucky to have got my youngest son to the age of 18. So I think the people with children younger than that are the people that really have the concern because it's the unknown quantity. There's a number of schools I know of that are trying now to eliminate phones in schools because I remember back to when that son of 18 was in first class, somebody got an iPhone. And unless the schools and the parents come together and try and agree on something to at least limit it during the school hours and days, but it's a major problem. I see my grandchildren glued to it, and the best parent in the world will do their best to try and prevent them seeing stuff that they shouldn't see. But it's a scary, outlook, I think, for the younger generations.
Yeah, Mick, is this just more rock and roll, rot your brain, and the radio is going to kill people's attention span, etc., etc.? I mean, it is the way the kids are interacting with each other these days as well. And
there's some positives in that respect. I've teenage boys and it scares the living daylights out of me. Boys and girls, there's particular dangers separately for both of them. I'm just scared out of my life in terms of boys, in terms of every element that's on it.
Are you monitoring their phones and their phone use?
No, I'm finding it difficult to do that. Yeah. I find that very hard.
We don't know enough, basically.
No, exactly. And like I was just out for a bit of grub there on Friday night, and there was a couple sitting beside us, and they had a child who I'd say was possibly two. And this is what struck me, the bad knowledge, I think, things are for people with teenagers today. The child, looked over a few times, the child was on the screen playing a game for the whole time. Mm. Now, all I was saying to myself is, thanks be to God, it wasn't that bad when my kids were that age, but today it's got even worse. And even that, I still think it's horrendous for anyone. You have to hope that at some stage there's going to be a rollback societally, because without that, I don't know where this is going to go.
Would you have any hope with that, Emmanuel?
I think there are different issues here. I see it, I can't remember who I heard on the radio saying that we should bring in a ban of mobile phones in schools, right? And this has been done in France already, I think, largely. At the same time, I know that a lot of schools are underfunded, so they can't buy iPads. They get the kids to use their phone to do the Kahoot quiz or to do the whatever, you know, which is part of the learning tool to assess their knowledge, etc. So it is used in schools. It serves a purpose, I mean, in school, unless we totally go off any kind of computer, social media, etc. That's one way. The other thing, can I just say, as a lecturer, and I'm sure Robbie does the same, I try to get grants. My funder that I go to usually would be the European Commission. All they want is actually digital-based learning material, etc. So I work with kids. I work with primary and secondary schools. They wanted web-based. They wanted, interactive games and etc. So they want all of this. And that's how you get your funding. So, yes, unless we literally go back 100 years ago, I can't see how. And just in terms of the interactions with my children, so I have a big span. I have a 4, an 11, a 13 and a 15-year-old. It's interesting to see that the way I've approached it is my 13 and 15-year-old, I talk to them in advance of the horrible things that they'll encounter on social media. So I hear on the radio everything regarding, teenagers seeing porn within, as you said, about 20 minutes of being there or etc. I talk to my kids about this. They seem to be more frightened than ever. But yes, fundamentally, I agree. We do not control the beast.
It's an interesting point, though. It is a digital world, and like you want your kid to be able to use these things. Kids with special needs, it's a whole new way for them to learn and interact and all of that kind of thing, you know. So we can't roll back time. You do have a particular problem, Emmanuel, though. You've picked a piece by Roisin Kelly in the Sunday Times around the phones in the gym situation.
Yes, absolutely. I thought this piece was actually quite funny. I'm not a gym bunny like Roisin Kelly. She clearly says she goes to the gym very regularly. But I have been in the gym with, she identifies four categories: the TikTok narcissist, the Mr. Grunty, the space invader, and the equipment hog. And I think I've come across all of those once going to the gym. And quite honestly, it is painful. And it's back I think social media has been quite a link or, you know, a red thread of our discussion this morning. But she says that the moment she sees a tripod with a phone coming up, she kind of runs a mile to make sure she's not in that video. She just goes through the different ways of being intimidated in the gym by different people, whether they try to mansplain you how to use the equipment or whether they try to film themselves to post it immediately on Instagram or TikTok or something.
Yeah, okay. That's our weekly go off internet and phones and cameras and everything else. Now, Robbie, cameras have been good to Ireland this year as well. You picked out a piece in the Sunday Times about the IFTAs last night.
Yeah.
What a show of strength Ireland, wasn't it?
And a multi-generational one. And I kind of thought it was great that, you know, Stephen Ray was getting a Lifetime Award. A lot of focus now on the Cillian Murphy and the new generation, but it's 40, 50 years of great Irish actors and directors and writers and producers that have made this possible. I still have to work off brownie points at home for bringing my wife to see Stephen Ray in Crap's Last Tape, which I thought was great. But it's great that we can actually see people like that on the stage in Ireland. I saw him in David Ireland's Cypress Avenue as well. And I don't know other places like a city like Dublin where you can see actors like that on stage.
Yeah, yeah. And Stephen Ray, I think, made the point yesterday. What film was he talking about? That at one stage, when he was making one of his early films with, I think, Neil Jordan or whatever, it was the only film being produced in Ireland or England at the time. Like, and you look at the situation now where we have the winner for the best Oscar winning at the IFTAs last night, and he's from Cork. It's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it, Mick?
It's unbelievable, yeah. I saw him one day in Patrick Street in Cork across the road. I waved at him, but he was on his phone. He didn't spot
me. Even him. Lorraine, I know there is one thing you did want to get in, and I've tried to keep a few minutes for it, but this is about business supports and about the state of businesses around the country and the COVID debt, which is on the front of the Business Post. The COVID warehousing debt is coming down the line, the deadline for that as well.
Yes, well, there's a number of articles this week actually in the paper about, in particular, small business. And there's in the Irish Times, or sorry, the Sunday Times, there on page 8, there's tourism sector would warmly welcome more help. And the tourism sector around the country is on its knees. In particular, the hospitality sector, the restaurants and cafes are having a very difficult time since the VAT was increased last September. Also, alongside that, the increases in food, in labour, minimum wage has made a huge difference, and just general utility costs and overhead costs in the business. And quite honestly, I think the government has an opportunity now. It's a year before there's going to be an election, and there's a new breeze in coming in with Simon Harris. And if he doesn't take decisive action to try and rescue these small businesses and hospitality businesses around the country, it's really going to become a nightmare scenario.
Do what?
Well, there was mention at the Ardesh, at their Ardesh, that they were going to reduce the VAT rate for hospitality sector back down to 9%. But there seems to be a pullback in that today. Now that they're going,
there's been talk of a split of it. Would you agree with that? That,
well,
basically big hotels, like there was a piece in the Business Post about how I think Mount Juliet now is for sale for like multiples of what was 15 million paid for it,
but whatever, these are
within the last 10 years
properties.
Now. Yeah,
but these are big businesses buying.
The Shelburne sold for a huge amount of money because 5-star hotels viewed as being inflation proof. They just put up the price and their customers don't mind.
But they're also,
is there an argument though that there are some people at a certain level in the hospitality industry do not need what would essentially be the government giving them back.
Yes, and the most recent proposal was that they would divide out the VAT rate reduction and they would split it away, and accommodation providers would not get the reduced rate. And I'm in both. I'm in the cafe business and I'm also in the hotel business. And I would say that the cafe and restaurant business in this country cannot afford the high rate of VAT. And the right thing to do now at this time is to split it away, and that accommodation pays 13.5% VAT. that, and food businesses pay 9%.
You would be agreeable to that?
I would be agreeable to that.
Is it workable, do you think?
I think it's workable, yeah. I think it's workable. But what's the real problem is that, you know, we're going to end up eating fast food. Our tourism, we're 9 million tourists come into the country every year, and they don't come for a burger. They come for Irish food. And there are so many restaurants closing around the country. And I'm not just talking about Dublin or Cork, where we see them highlighted. I'm talking about in the small towns and rural villages on the Wild Atlantic Way and places like that, where you stop off for a genuine Irish meal, not for something that's chicken in a batter, whatever it is. So what I think is that they really have a small window of opportunity now to make change. And I'm scared that as of this morning in the front page of the Business Post, they're saying that they're going to row back and probably just give a tax rebate instead of...
Okay, that's your pitch for very business worried. Done there. Yeah. Okay, just we have about a minute left. Emmanuel, this is it's a pet obsession of mine. You picked a piece on Toyota.
Oh, yes, yes.
The one company, the one car company who didn't screw up massively by pouring billions into EVs and EVs
exactly.
only.
And actually the VP there has a great piece in the paper talking about the fact that it could have been foreseen.
So it's in the Business Post. EU got it wrong and pushed for electric vehicles over hybrids.
Exactly. That there should be an investment in R&D. We should push for different technologies, and that there is, Tesla and Build Your Dreams there, BYD, have seen the projection of purchase of EVs gone massively down. The article mentions Europeans are to buy nearly 9 million fewer EVs between now and 2030. So the Toyota VP there is insisting on the fact that, yes, the European Green Deal struck by the European Union meant carbon neutral by 2050. But
there are different ways of getting there.
But there are different ways,
and
hydrogen
hybrids might be
in particular could be. Yeah. Part of the solution.
Okay, that's all we have time for in that hour. Thank you very much to Dr. Robbie Smith, Dr. Emmanuel Sean Quinlivan, Dr. Lorraine Sweeney, and plain old Mick Clifford. And it's just 12 o'clock now, and we'll go to the newsroom and Vivian Traynor.